This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe.
31 years ago on December 8th, John Lennon was shot and killed on the sidewalk in front of his home. Reams of words have been written about that senseless, irrevocable act. Writer and critic Tim Riley prefers the parts of John Lennon's stories that are not so well known. His quest is for the deep and lasting meaning of four lads from austere post-war Liverpool discovering rock and roll.
The Beatles' accomplishment is so big. Everyone knows it's so big, but what is that accomplishment about? These are really four Liverpool boys who were so smitten by American rock and roll. And when they appear on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964, they are just full-grown masters of the style. That's part of what blows America away about it.
The Beatles!
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you.
America continued to be blown away by the John Lennon they knew. Riley writes about that John and peels back new layers of the man in a book called Lennon, The Man, The Myth, and His Music. An NPR critic and Beatles scholar, Tim Riley spent years traveling to Liverpool and other places to speak to those who knew John Lennon. From his research, he composes a warts and all portrait of John Lennon from the world that made him.
The history of rock and roll as he heard it was very different than what most Americans heard. When he started listening to rock and roll in 56 and 57, he could only hear it one night a week on they called it offshore radio. It was basically illegal radio, and the signal, you had to listen to it at night. It was coming from Europe and 1 hour a week, and his friend Pete Shotton said, he expected all his friends to tune in. It was a religious thing. It was like it was so exciting and new and fantastical. And the more research I did, I realized that Britain has a totally different history of the 50s than America has. America's 50s are full of abundance, and Britain is in a period of what they call austerity Britain. Mm. They're still paying off their war debt and rationing food. To be from Britain in the 50s was to really be an outsider, like more of an outsider than we can imagine right now.
John Lennon says that before Elvis, there was nothing. Suddenly, it was like the Messiah had come. So something got released in this scrimping economical culture. And some of those myths about John growing up become sort of standard lines, like that his father abandoned him, for example. You write about it slightly differently. What did you find?
It really is an abandonment, but it's much more complicated than a simple abandonment. He was not present for most of young John's first 5 years, and then he shows up quite suddenly and picks the 5-year-old John up at his Aunt Mimi's house, where his mom has stashed him, and he takes him off to Blackpool for a holiday. To the young 5-year-old John Lennon, to go off on this holiday in Blackpool was this most magical thing that could have ever happened to him. Well, what we learn is that Alfred was actually planning to kidnap him and take him to New Zealand, which presents this fascinating parallel universe. If Lennon had gotten kidnapped to New Zealand, we might have had New Zealand Beatles. And apparently it almost happened, because it was a couple days before he was about to leave that Julia, his mother, shows up and tracks him down to come pick him up. But it's this very complicated scene in the front room of this house in Blackpool. Alfred very much wants to get back together with Julia, but Julia is determined to take him back home with her new boyfriend, Bobby Dykens. And there's a standoff. They can't decide what to do, so they call John into the front room and they say, okay, you have to choose now. Are you going to go off with your dad in New Zealand or back home to Liverpool with your mother?
So he was 5 years old at this time.
They put this question to this 5-year-old kid. Now, everything that I learned about Lennon up to this point tells me that he was a very smart, sensitive kid, and I think that he understood that the question was loaded and unfair, and that his experience of his parents was that they handed him off, both parents. And so he goes to his father first, sits on his lap, but he watches his mother get up and walk out of the house and down the street. So he watches his mother essentially give him up. And that's too wrenching. So he races down the street after her, and he doesn't see his father again for 15, 18 years. He goes back to Liverpool, and she indeed installs him at her sister's house, and he's raised by her sister, his Aunt Mimi.
It's such a dramatic scene. You know, this sensitive child grows up to be a kid who loves rock and roll. Julia, his mother, completely supported his love of rock and roll, bought him his first guitar. but he's also kind of emotionally frozen when she is killed, sort of stamping a pattern of an emotionally shut down person. How do we reckon that with the extreme sensitivity and ability to touch human beings through his music?
Right. So this is the core duality we have. We have somebody who suffered immense traumatic loss, like more loss than I can certainly conceive of by the time he's five. And then there's more loss to come, obviously. He loses his mother when he's 17. He loses his best friend, Stu Sutcliffe, a couple years later. So he's a very angry young man, but he's also extremely sensitive. So he does kind of channel all of his passion into his music. And I think that's what we hear in especially a lot of the early tunes, where there is this great sense of abundance and good cheer, which is simply his joy of music making, his joy of finding a path, his joy of finding an identity, a role to play in life through rock and roll. And then ultimately, if you listen to that early rock and roll closely enough, you start to hear these strains of darkness, of the loss, the pain. And he ultimately works his craft so well, he flexes that creativity muscle so well that he's able to express a great deal of pain by later in the Beatle career and then the solo career. It's an exercise in how to form an identity through the music in a much deeper level.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that early rock and roll from the Beatles from the early 60s. Let's listen to the song If I Fell. This is from the soundtrack of Hard Day's Night.
So I hope you see that I would love to love you. She learns we are two, 'cause I couldn't stand the pain, and I would be sad if our new love was in vain. So I hope you see.
That's John Lennon and Paul McCartney there, of course. Do I need to even back announce these songs? These are so deeply embedded in our consciousness. But a duet there. Talk a little bit about that partnership between John and Paul, which was fraught in some places and in others just an extremely beneficial gift to all of us.
He meets Paul at a church dance in Liverpool and is immediately intimidated and kind of impressed with young Paul, who pulls out and plays an Eddie Cochran song on his guitar for him to kind of audition. And he decides to take him into the band, and they are fast friends. They have a certain kind of blend as duet partners in their own music and in other people's songs that just really is very special right from the word go. And this duet conveys many, many things, but most of all it conveys just great love of partnership and love of the music itself. This really intense, intimate bond and fraternity that you just don't get almost anywhere else. And then they do help each other find and form their own identities through the music, and that's their key project. And then slowly across the Beatles' career, what you hear developing in that blend is slowly growing apart as friends outside of music. Their lives begin to take on these incredibly different paths, and they choose these very different women to marry in their late 20s. And yet they still sound great together. So when we get to late duets, later songs like I've Got a Feeling or I Dig a Pony or Don't Let Me Down, then we have these really interesting twilight duets where they still sound great together, but you can tell they're kind of waving goodbye to each other. And the music really kept them together, I think, a lot longer than almost anything else could have. I think they had a terrible time breaking up, and I think that shows in the way they behaved and the rift that formed between them that became a big legal battle. They both go off into their solo careers with their wives. So this has always struck me as a statement that they both consider music making a profoundly intimate exercise, and that they had a profound intimacy together, Lennon and McCartney, and that to go off and make music as solo artists meant they wanted to bring their new intimate partners right there with them on stage.
But the relationship between Paul and John post-Beatles, what was that like? I mean, we get a lot of rumors of public sniping, whispers of near reconciliation. Were they ever close to writing songs together again?
I have some really interesting testimony from members of a band that John Lennon worked with in 1972, the Elephant's Memory Band. And I had one member of that band tell me that it was really typical that Paul McCartney would ring up for John Lennon in the middle of a rehearsal. Lennon would take the call, and the band would take a break for an hour while they listened to one side of this conversation between Lennon and McCartney on the other end. So this is a completely common occurrence, and they sit and talk for an hour about all things family, music, catching up. These band members told me they sounded like the best of friends. Now, this is during a period where we know that their lawyers are being pit bulls with one another and fighting, really, one of the great epic legal battles in music publishing.
We're going to take a short break and continue the conversation with Tim Riley, a Beatles scholar and author of several books about music. His newest is called Lennon, The Man, The Myth, and His Music. Stay with us for more of a portrait of Lennon gleaned from conversations with those who knew him. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Don't please believe me, I'd hate to miss the train. Oh yeah.
We're back with Beatles scholar and NPR critic Tim Riley on a tremendously creative and influential life that was cut short 31 years ago on December 8th.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever.
Tim is out with Lennon, The Man, The Myth, and His Music, a book praised for its insight and unvarnished portrait of John Lennon. Tim, put your critic hat on for a minute as we roll back to two songs that you write reveal the differences in the Lennon-McCartney partnership, both personally and creatively. This song, Strawberry Fields Forever by John Lennon, and Penny Lane by Paul McCartney, both released in 1967 during the Sgt. Pepper sessions.
The title of that song is referring to a charity home near where John Lennon grew up. It's called Strawberry Fields. You can still go see it. Many people still visit as kind of a pilgrimage. And Lennon used to hop the walls of that home because it had a great yard with trees, and it's a childhood idol for him. So he was writing this song in the fall of 66 after the Beatles had taken their last world tour together, and he was really seriously thinking about leaving the band at this point, which at the time was kind of unimaginable to think he'd be in the biggest act of the history of show business. But he had grown really tired, and they had pushed the Beatles as far as they could with Revolver. You know, they've really just taken things much further than anybody expected them to go, even by 1966. I mean, seriously thinking, you know, what's next? And, of course, what's next is Sgt. Pepper, another triumph. But along the way, they decide, well, let's write songs about our childhood. So he comes and he plays this Strawberry Fields Forever alone on a stool with the acoustic guitar. And there's a quote from George Martin, their producer, who says, "It was easily like the high point of my life hearing Lennon sing that song for the first time. You can imagine."
Sometimes think it's me, but you know I know when it's a dream. I think I know, I mean, yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree.
And then McCartney goes off and writes, you know, what is essentially an answer song, which is, oh, yeah, I'll write about my view of the same things. And he writes about Penny Lane, which is a bus roundabout. For McCartney, it is really quite an interesting philosophical conundrum, because there's that wonderful line in the song about how the nurse is selling poppies from a tray, and although she feels she's in a play, she is anyway. So he clearly is drawing on Lennon's idea of his Liverpool childhood as being a kind of surreal place, as though all the normal things that they had as children, they did kind of sparkle in their own way, and that's what you get from these two songs.
You say drawing on, not trying to one-up, not trying to outdo, you don't see that?
Well, they always described it as a very competitive relationship, so they were trying to one-up each other, but it's interesting that you know, McCartney chooses fairly standard pop music structures, and he's always trying to reach a very wide audience. He has a very innate pop sense, very melodic, very cheerful, very upbeat. And you think, oh, that's just a bright, sunny pop song. But it really does have this interesting thought riddle right in the center of it. And he gets away with that because he's so cagey in many other aspects of it. Lennon is just right out there with his experimental nature. I mean, he's just got a completely surreal idea for a song. It doesn't have refrains, doesn't have regular verses. All of the images in the song are completely original. He's writing completely outside the box with the song.
Now, the other picture we get of John in the book is as somebody who is bad at confrontation, who is bad at leaving. Some examples are how he leaves his wife, Cynthia, the mother of his child, Julian, and how he leaves the Beatles. And I wonder if you could illuminate that for us in any way.
Yeah. What you have with Lennon is, you know, he's somebody who externalized this incredible personality. Everybody knows the big, chatty side of Lennon. He was a quote machine. He was a big personality, big humored, big-hearted, sentimental, blustering, you know, could project a really terrific facade to the world at large. But in his intimate relationships and the people he was closest to, he was extremely meek, it seems, and fearful, and avoided confrontation at all costs. So the received wisdom has always been that Yoko Ono sort of kidnaps him and breaks the band up. And I really found some very, very different kinds of evidence that that's really not true. The first being that Lennon, you know, was certainly the only member of the Beatles who could have brought someone like Yoko Ono into rehearsals with the band. That really was not something that was done. So Lennon initiates doing this, and he insists on her voicing her opinions and becoming kind of a band member herself, without asking any of the other Beatles or even introducing her to the producer, George Martin. He really never takes responsibility for doing it. He lets Yoko take the rap for breaking the band up. But, you know, he is the one who's insisting that she be there the whole time.
Cynthia, his ex-wife, describes the scene where she basically comes home and finds that Yoko has moved in.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't imagine a more difficult breakup scene. So Cynthia's gone off to Italy for a short vacation, and when she comes home, she finds Yoko lounging in her slippers in the Lennon family
room. It's like an old R&B song or something.
Right, right. And Lennon, and they barely acknowledge Cynthia. It's though, you know, like Lennon has just had this lover overnight, and the wife can stuff it, basically. His both of their behavior is really pretty indefensible in a scene like that. Now, from Cynthia, we know that they get together even after that. They reconcile. They've been working on this marriage for a couple of years, but he's kind of still pulled too much to Yoko, and he winds up choosing Yoko, but the way he does it is just so cruel and heartless, not just to Cynthia, but to the young child, Julian.
Well, you also write that about the time that he gets together with Yoko, there were some delusions, or at least him sharing with the rest of the band and Apple officials, that he was Jesus Christ. I mean, is this a mental breakdown, or is this just too many drugs? What do you think was going on for him?
I think the research that I've done shows that he was much more depressed and much more drug dependent than we ever knew, so that when he does finally settle with Yoko, that would be the spring of 68, he is sort of coming out of this massive depression, and Yoko is this, she's like a portal to a whole new life, and that's what he sees in her, and that's what he uses her for, and that's his escape hatch. And there is this very funny story about him calling a meeting with all the Beatles and announcing that he's Jesus Christ. It's a bizarre episode, and yet, you know, for Lennon, it's not as bizarre as it would be for many other people. I think it's a mental breakdown. I think it's drugs. I think it's egomania. You know, none of us know what it feels like to be John Lennon. He was an astronaut, right? He was adored by everybody in the world, and yet he felt really, really depressed and isolated. And you don't know how that feels. I mean, the air is really thin up there, and it's very, very hard to get inside somebody's head who's the object of global adoration.
A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
Tim Riley is with us. He's author of a new biography of John Lennon, who was killed on December 8th, 1980. Well, one of the things that you do, Tim, in your book is debunk that myth that he was indeed a working-class hero.
When you go to Liverpool and you get in the cab and you tell the cabbie that you're working on a book about John Lennon, the first thing all the cabbies said to me was, well, he was no working-class hero. Let me just be clear about that. He was raised in Woolton. He was given a proper middle-class upbringing. He was a good middle-class boy. In fact, he was the only Beatle who was raised with indoor plumbing. What he's singing about there is the British class system. And so he's a lifelong opponent of this class system, and the Working Class Hero song is a very embittered and ironic statement of defiance about how false and misleading this whole class system really is.
Then they expect you to pick a career.
He does find refuge with Yoko in New York, at least a refuge from British taxes. and becomes a kind of American John. I have to roll us through the years here and mention the infamous Lost Weekend when Yoko kicks him out. He spends about 18 months in L.A. making records with Harry Nilsson, getting into a lot of trouble. Although his lover, May Pang, tells you that John and Yoko were talking every day for hours, so maybe not so lost after all. Paul McCartney, of all people, plays middleman in getting the back together, and John eventually moves back into the Dakota for what, from the outside, seemed to be his last blissful years.
I have testimony from a lot of different people about it's not really as clean and simple as they wanted to portray it to people.
Yeah, that's what I wonder, Tim. I mean, right. How does somebody with this kind of an ego, this kind of habits for drugs and alcohol, suddenly settle down and everything's supposed to be okay?
Well, this is another much misunderstood aspect, this last five-year leg of his life, where he is basically retired from the music industry and simply being a house husband. They have their son, Sean. He wins his court case to stay in America. And he settles down, and she sort of gives him the freedom at this point to not feel compelled to sing and write and perform. And he earns a long, peaceful rest from the craziness of the business. And if you're John Lennon, it really is the most okay that it's ever been. And it does seem as though he's weaned himself off many, many drugs, and that he devotes himself quite fully to this young child, and that the child really inspires new things in him, and he's very devoted to this new family. I mean, it is as much of a leap forward as you might possibly hope for from somebody like John Lennon.
Well, let's hear from just one of the most touching and lovely testaments of that love of John Lennon for his little boy, Sean. This is Beautiful Boy.
Close your eyes. Have no fear. The monster's gone. He's on.
What did we lose when John Lennon was killed?
Well, we lost a great comic spirit. I mean, I like to think of him at age 71 now. I think he'd be just fantastically entertaining old guy who would be right down at the front lines of Occupy Wall Street, picketing, chanting slogans, writing songs for these guys. He definitely would have gotten a kick out of Occupy Wall Street. You know, I like to think that he would have kept on writing. His writing was launching into a new direction. A lot of people didn't like that it was softer, it was more composed, it was less experimental. But I think he would have found his way to a new area where he would have treated us to a whole raft of new songs. And you can think of many other partnerships he might have been involved with over the years.
All right, Tim Riley, dare I ask if you have a favorite or most emblematic Beatles song that we can leave the audience with?
I like to choose Don't Let Me Down. He's kind of waving goodbye to the Beatles as they play this song. There's this very strong sense of Beatle twilight in this song that I quite like.
Don't let me down. Don't let me down.
Tim Riley, I want to thank you so much for opening up some of the myth, the music, and the man of John Lennon for us today.
Thank you, Virginia.
Tim Riley is a professor of journalism at Emerson College, an NPR critic, an author, most recently of Lennon, the Man, the Myth, and His Music. You'll find more on the book, including some emphatic notices from the New York Times Book Review. We hope that you learned something new about John Lennon today, or maybe that you can imagine him in a new way. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Yes, she does.